You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Next Monday, Albert Einstein turns 126 years old. Normally, 126 wouldn't be a big milestone, but this is 2005, the centennial of Einstein's miracle year in 1905. Albert Einstein was born in 1879 in Ulm, Germany, the first child born to Hermann and Pauline Einstein. And just 26 years later, he was creating ideas that had changed the path of physics. Joining me now to help us remember Einstein, the scientist and Einstein the man, is Dennis Overby, science correspondent for The New York Times and author of the book Einstein in Love, published by Viking Adult. He joins me here in our studios. Welcome back to the program.
It's nice to be here.
You've been writing about Einstein and his ideas for many years. I know when I see a Dennis Overby piece in The Times, it's going to be about relativity or Einstein or something really, really interesting, always fascinating, Dennis. Why do you find Einstein such a fascinating character and subject?
I think everybody finds Einstein fascinating, and it seems that the more time goes on and the more we learn about him, the more fascinating he becomes. He's just such a rich character, and there's so many aspects to his life and his personality. You know, he's a pacifist who helped start the atomic bomb. He's many things.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's a good segue for me, because no one knew Einstein better than those who worked with him, both in Europe before he escaped Nazi Germany and in the U.S. at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And in 1979, on Einstein's 100th birthday, they had a big birthday party at the Institute there. And I had the opportunity to interview some of Einstein's former colleagues, assistants, his students. Of course, most of them are no longer with us. And I put together a little bit of a tape from an interview I did for All Things Considered back then. Memories of meeting, talking, and working with Einstein, as heard through the voices of Arthur Komar, Valentin Bargmann, Abraham Pius, Lou Friedman, and Banish Hoffman. And this is what it sounded like.
He spoke slowly and clearly, with a very heavily German-accented English.
Einstein was immensely friendly. I felt very welcome to come to his office anytime I felt like.
I said, "You mean me? Go and see Einstein? Impossible." And I really pretty well had to be shoved in. I knocked on the door, and Einstein inside said, "Come," in that rising inflection, not "come in," but "come," like that. And so I went in, trembling, and he was sitting there smoking a pipe. And then he said this. He said, "Please put the equations on the board, and please go slowly, because I don't understand things quickly." And as soon as he said that, I felt such a relaxation. No more was I afraid of the man, as it were. And I don't know why those words should have put me at ease like that, but he had a real talent for putting people at ease, when he wanted to put them at ease, that is. There was never any feeling of antagonism. It was as if he and I were partners, and the enemy was the equations or the idea. And that, it was quite extraordinary, but never after that was I afraid of the man.
Einstein loved anything far out. Eric Carle once got a can of diamond-backed rattlesnake meat, and they said, they mentioned as a joke that if they called up Einstein at 3 or 4 in the morning and said they had some rattlesnake meat, he'd say, "One minute, I'll be right over."
Thing that occurred to me as I worked with Einstein was that what I had been taught as to the nature of science was all wrong. When we got into a situation where we didn't quite know what to do next, Einstein would say, I mean, we would be looking at each other in blank despair, and then Einstein would say, "I will a little think." And that was his best way of saying, "I will think a little." And then he would
twirl his hair like this, and he would walk up and down or stand still, and his face had no sense of strain at all. He seemed as if he was sort of in another part of the universe, only his body being with us. After a while, he would suddenly relax, come back to Earth, look at us, smile at us, and say, yes, we should do such and such. And, of course, it worked, and that was how we got out of those very deep difficulties. Now, Infeld and I had hoped that by working with Einstein, we would learn how is it done. We were looking at the thing being done in front of us, and there wasn't the least clue how was it.
Einstein was, in my experience at least, by far the most creative person I've ever met. Many creative people are very uncritical toward their own ideas. They may be very critical toward the ideas of others. Einstein could work up tremendous enthusiasm, but there would always come the moment of truth. Einstein discovered a fatal flaw in what he himself had initiated and ruthlessly cut off that attempt, only to take on a new idea for work, usually within a few days.
He was a free man. I have not known in my lifetime any man who was freer. He was not a rebel. He has been sometimes characterized as a rebel. I think he was not a rebel. He was not a man who on purpose wanted to overthrow existing concepts. But when his work would force him to do so, then he did, because he felt it to be inevitable.
He was always looking for beauty in his work, and also a profound religious sense. When he was finding wonderful laws, simple laws in the universe, it was really a religious experience for him of the most profound sort, even though he did not believe in a personal God, as you know.
His science was the central thing, and sort of next to the science was music. He asked me to come, and we played piano-violin duets, violin-piano duets, and was Mozart and Beethoven, essentially. Einstein was really first-rate for an amateur, you know, really first-rate. He was excellent intonation and a very profound feeling and understanding of the music.
Liegt Deutschland in uns, marschiert Deutschland, und hinter uns kommt Deutschland.
See, the Nazis came to power in 1933, but there were people who were refugees from Nazism, and they wanted to come, for example, to America. He was very busy trying to help people escape from the Nazis. He must have saved many lives. And very often, complete strangers who begged Einstein to help, and he did whenever he could. You see, Einstein, because of his prominence, could do things about peace.
Einstein knew he was a legend. He did nothing to promote it. He got no particular joy out of it. He was offended if anybody made use of this legendary aspect of him. I mean, he was a very private person, and he cherished his privacy, and he knew that the world was very hungry for legend, and that this hunger could be stilled by the type of person he was. But he did not very much care for such roles at all. Courage was one facet of his strength. Persistence was another. A great endurance.
He was a person of wisdom. He had firm ideas, but also an enormous compassion and humanity. And that, I think, is the main thing.
Reminiscences about Einstein from people who knew him, his students, his fellow scientists, and recorded 1979, almost 26 years ago. I'm sitting here with Dennis Overby of the New York Times. Dennis, any reaction to all those words?
Yeah, I'm still sort of floating away on that. I mean, many thoughts come to mind. One that occurred early on when Einstein said, I learn slowly, so speak slowly. I mean, he often attributed his success to being sort of a retarded learner who only as adult got around to asking the kinds of questions that children ask, but he asked them more deeply and stubbornly. Mm-hmm. And I think great art and great science come from questioning the obvious. And it takes a special genius to recognize that the obvious things that need to be questioned. When you talk to modern day scientists about what made Einstein great, one thing they always come back to is this sort of almost biological need he had for logic and consistency in the laws of physics, and he could ferret out flaws or contradictions or paradoxes that nobody even knew existed, and this is what led him to relativity and also led him to its antithesis, quantum theory, because he was one of the great pioneers of quantum mechanics, even though that was a theory that he disavowed. He thought these kind of uncertainty principle, these sort of statistical paradoxical rules about atomic behavior could not be the full answer because he believed strongly in cause and effect. But in fact, in his early life, he was one of the founders of quantum theory, and he kind of kept the theory alive almost like somebody cupping a match in his hand in a wind for several years until it caught on. Hmm. So, I mean, he's very interesting from that standpoint.
Talking with Dennis Overby of the New York Times, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We've heard a lot about these were men talking about influences in his lives, but you were very instrumental in written books about Mileva. Some of the people who knew him better, who could not have known him better, were the voices of his wives, right?
Well, that's right. And one of the sort of interesting complexities of his character is he's somebody who stands as a symbol of abstract thought and sort of divorced from earthly realities. But in fact, when he was a young man, he had this very turbulent, passionate love affair, a kind of Romeo and Juliet relationship with his girlfriend, Mileva Merrick, who became his wife, more or less over his father's dead body, basically, and his mother's everlasting scorn.
The title of your book, Einstein in Love, was he really? It's hard to think of Einstein being in love, you know?
Well, that's one of the reasons for the title, that it kind of stops you in your tracks, and it's meant to make you, I mean, to sort of reevaluate who is Einstein, what do we really know about him, what kind of person was he, and so, I mean, that sounds almost contradictory, and I think, well, people read the book, they can argue about what or who Einstein was in love with and when. Certainly one great love affair of his life was physics and this passion to understand the universe ultimately took precedence over everything else. Mm-hmm. But there were many women along the way. His romantic personal life was not a happy one.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't talked about very much in those days.
Those were different days.
Yeah. Today it would be totally different.
I'm afraid he'd be, you know, Howard Stern would be after him every morning.
How do you think he'd react to it if he were still alive? How do you think he'd react to everything going on around?
I think he'd be appalled.
Yeah. Anything particular would be appalling to him?
I think he'd be appalled at, the whole Clinton-Lewinsky affair, the obsessive interest of Americans in the sexual peccadilloes and other intimate aspects of celebrities' lives, or the whole celebrity worship thing, which, I mean, he, in some ways, he was the first rock star.
He was
certainly the first rock star of science. He was maybe the first rock star of the 20th century. So he knew what it felt like. I mean, he would know exactly what the Beatles were going through when they were going through what they were going through.
Did he shun publicity?
You know, he played into it in a way, because, I mean, Einstein consciously created this image of the wandering eccentric, the holy fool, wandering Princeton with no socks and his frizzy hair. But if you kind of look beneath the surface, he's very sharp. He's attuned to everything that's going on around him. He spent 2 hours reading the New York Times every day. There was a telling comment in that tape where he was very good at making his friends feel comfortable if he wanted to make feel comfortable, but he could make them feel terrible. And all his associates, especially when he was a young man, were kind of a little bit afraid of his wit and his scathing scorn. When he wanted to be that way, he could be quite devastating. So he's a fascinating guy. And I was on this show a few years ago, and you asked why people liked Einstein, and somebody said he was the human face of science. But I think he's more than that. I think he's actually the human face of humanity.
Very interesting. Dennis, we'll have to ask you back and finish that, because we've run out of time. Dennis Overby, who is a science correspondent for the New York Times, author of the book Einstein in Love. If you want to know more about it, read his book. Very interesting. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Mitchell Baker, president of the Mozilla Foundation, talk about Firefox, web browser, where are they going from here, and you'll get your chance to talk to her. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.